Once the smoke cleared from the Cicero elections, Eddie Vogel, the underworld mover and shaker of the town who gave orders to the mayor and other local officials, kept his promise to Torrio and Capone about gambling. On May 1st, they opened Cicero's first bookmaking and gambling operation, the Hawthorne Smoke Shop, right next door to their Cicero headquarters, the Hawthorne Inn. They put a trustworthy hood named Frankie Pope in charge of what was called a floating handbook, which meant that the place could be moved around to other locations when needed, because from time to time, it was raided by the police for appearances' sake, but they always gave ample warning before they arrived so that everything could be temporarily moved to another spot. The successful takeover of Cicero was a cause for celebration for the outfit, but Capone was still mourning the death of his brother. Frank's funeral had been a somber affair. Dino Banyan had lived up to his reputation for extravagant floral displays, though. He bought out his wholesalers and had his people working around the clock to create the wreaths and arrangements needed for the services. Tens of thousands of dollars were spent on the affair and even eclipsed the splendor of Big Jim Colosimo's funeral. The coffin was satin-lined and silver-plated, and the massive floral display eclipsed anything seen in Chicago before. By noon on the day of the funeral, the Capone house had been filled with flowers, and even more were heaped on the front porch and the front lawn. When they ran out of space, wreaths and baskets were hung on trees and on light poles across the street. In Cicero, as a sign of respect, nearly all the saloon owners closed their blinds and locked their doors for 2 hours when the funeral took place. Frank was buried in the family plot in Mount Olivet Cemetery. Capone, although still in mourning, was nevertheless cheered by their continued success in Cicero. They eventually had 161 gambling operations in town, all of them operating 24 hours a day and all of them selling beer and liquor. Many of them were owned outright by Torrio and Capone, and they took 25% to 30% of the gross right off the top. Each place had gunmen on hand to protect the proprietors and cash from bandits. All these places, along with Cicero's other 123 saloons, bought their beer from Torrio's breweries and their liquor from O'Banion's Northside mob. Things were running smoothly in Cicero, this small but growing town of just over 16,000 people at the time. Or, well, they were running smoothly for the most part. There was still one ongoing problem that needed to be dealt with. That problem's name was Eddie Tansel. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our latest season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of Al Capone, rival gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, speakeasies, gambling joints, dirty politicians, corrupt cops, and of course, the ghosts those violent days left behind. This is episode 8 of season 10, a season we call Murder City, and this episode is called Blood on a Barroom Floor. Eddie Tansel, just as he'd been when Torrio first proposed taking over criminal operations in Cicero, continued to be a thorn in the side of the outfit. He defied Torrio and the Westside O'Donnells, buying beer from anyone he wanted, and openly taunting them to do something about it. Early one Sunday morning, Miles O'Donnell and a friend, John Doherty, came into Tansel's saloon after an all-night bender and ordered breakfast. At a table across the room sat Tansel, his wife, head bartender Leo Klemus, and his star entertainment, a singer named Mamie McLean. Only one waiter, Martin Simmet, was working after a long, hectic night. After the two men finished eating, Simmet brought them their bill, which was just the excuse they'd been waiting for. O'Donnell began to loudly complain that the waiter had overcharged them. Simmet insisted that he hadn't. Things became so heated that O'Donnell jumped up out of his chair and grabbed the waiter by the front of his shirt. The tussle got the attention of Eddie Tansel, and he got up from his own table and was crossing the room when O'Donnell punched Simmet in the face. Tansel, who was a former prize fighter, stepped between the two men, but O'Donnell shoved him out of the way. The hot-headed Tansel snapped. Tensions had been growing between the saloon owner and the O'Donnells for months, and he'd reached his limit. He snatched a pistol out of his coat and swung it toward Miles O'Donnell. Just as O'Donnell pulled his own weapon and pointed it at Tansel, they pulled their triggers at the same time, and bullets slammed into the chests of both men. Meanwhile, John Doherty had pulled his own gun and started firing at Tansel. Bartender Leo Klimas and Martin Simmet rushed him and tried to take his weapon away. O'Donnell, who'd been wounded but wasn't out of the fight, turned his weapon toward Klimas and fired. The bullet slammed into the bartender and sent him crashing backward against a table. He tumbled over and collapsed, dead before he slumped to the floor. O'Donnell and Tansel, both men bleeding badly, continued firing at each other until both handguns were empty. O'Donnell had been hit 4 times, but managed to stumble out into the street, followed by Doherty. They ran in opposite directions. Tansel, although mortally wounded, grabbed another gun from behind the bar and went after O'Donnell, determined to kill him. As he burst through the bar's front doors, he fired wildly at the fleeing figure, only stopping when the revolver clicked on an empty chamber. With a cry of rage, he hurled the gun after him. It clattered on the pavement and slid underneath a parked car. This last frustrated effort took what was left of his strength, and he fell over into the street. Less than a half block away, the limping O'Donnell fell too. Tansel tried to crawl to the other man, but only managed a few feet before collapsing face down in the street. He was dying, and he knew it. When Martin Simmet appeared from the inside the saloon, Tansel choked out his final words to him, saying, quote, "Get him. He got me." Following his boss's final order, he walked over and started brutally kicking O'Donnell until the man stopped moving. Then he walked away, left him for dead. Jim Doherty, though, managed to get away. Wounded and bloody, he dragged himself to the hospital. Miles O'Donnell, believe it or not, survived both the 4 bullet wounds and the beating by Simmet, but he spent weeks in the hospital trying to recover. Once he did, Assistant State's Attorney William McSwiggin filed charges against both men, but couldn't persuade a grand jury to indict them. The violence in Cicero made the newspapers, much to the dismay of Mayor Klinna, who claimed the town's growing bad reputation was greatly exaggerated. It was, he insisted, no worse than Chicago, which is not really something to brag about. But at a press conference, he asked reporters a question that probably didn't seem as stupid as it was at the time. He asked innocently, quote, "Who could tell when one leaves Chicago and enters Cicero?" Well, a Chicago reporter quickly answered him using a great line, quote, "Well, if you smell gunpowder, you're in Cicero." But Cicero was only part of the operation in 1924. As promised before the election, Torrio and Capone brought no more prostitutes into town. They opened brothels next door instead. New sporting houses opened in nearby communities like Stickney, Berwyn, and Oak Park, which soon gave the organization 22 operating houses in the Chicago suburbs. They brought in a staggering $10 million a year. They usually weren't subtle about how they did this, simply because, well, they didn't have to be. Things became so bad in Forest View, a village on the edge of Cicero, that locals started sarcastically calling it Caponeville. Until recently, Forest View had been a sleepy farming community with a population of less than 300 people. It wasn't even incorporated as a town until an attorney named Joseph W. Nozick spent several pleasant days there conferring with a client about an upcoming case. As a war veteran and an official in the American Legion, he told several of his friends and fellow Legionnaires about the area, and they decided to support Nozick in his plan to have it officially designated as a town. It was incorporated in 1924, and at the first community meeting, Nozick was elected police magistrate, and his brother John elected president of the village board. They chose William Porky Dillon, who claimed to be a military veteran, as their police chief. In the celebratory days after the meeting, Chief Dillon informed Nozick that he'd been contacted by two local businessmen who wanted to build a hotel and social club in Forest View. Well, Nozick was thrilled. He knew how a new business could improve the village and eagerly encouraged Dillon to support their plans. But Nozick, of course, didn't know the local businessmen were Al and Ralph Capone. Once the hotel opened, it became clear it wasn't a hotel at all, and Nozick was appalled by the thugs, prostitutes, and shady clientele who had moved into his village. He ordered Dillon to get rid of them. The following day, Nozick ran into Ralph Capone, and what started as a pleasant conversation took a turn when Ralph told him that if he heard about him saying anything else about him and his brother, he'd throw Nozick into the village drainage canal. Thinking that Ralph was joking, Nozick replied, quote, "Well, if I go into the canal, you'll go with me." But Ralph wasn't kidding around. Early the next morning, two men kicked open Nozick's front door and they dragged him to the village hall. He found seven other thugs waiting for him there. He was punched, kicked, and beaten with gun butts until he was nothing but a crumpled, bloody heap lying on the floor. He begged for his life and was spared when he agreed to leave Forest View for good. He later recalled, quote, "I moved. Others were forced to move too. 18 or 20 of the respectable men in our village were slugged and beaten and driven away." When Forest View held its next election, all the winning candidates for village board, president, trustees, and police magistrate were Capone men. Porky Dillon continued as the chief of police, and by the way, he wasn't a military veteran. He was an ex-convict that had been pardoned by Governor Small, you know, the gangster's best friend. With free run of the town, Torrio and Capone opened their largest sporting house yet, the Maple Inn. On the main floor, it offered liquor, dancing, and slot machines. In a back room, customers chose from about 60 girls and then went upstairs to one of the 35 bedrooms. But this place was more than just a brothel. It was also a hideout, a suburban headquarters, and an ammunition dump. And legends say that it contained a maze of secret passages and rooms that were hidden behind walls, under floors, and above the ceilings. These passages offered a view of the customers in the bar, in the gambling area, or even in the bedrooms, using, and I'm not joking here, eyes cut out of wall paintings, just like in an episode of Scooby-Doo. Anyway, Caponeville continued to thrive until May 30th, 1926, when three carloads of men showed up at the Maple Inn, told the night watchman to leave, and set the building on fire. The Berwyn Fire Department watched it burn, claiming there was no water available to put out the blaze. The police, who had allegedly encouraged the arsonists, said there would be no investigation of the fire. "Good riddance," a county sheriff's department official said. Capone moved the operation north to Cicero after the fire, and with the mob's departure, the village faded until well after the Depression, reviving in the 1940s when Commonwealth Edison built a huge generating plant there. By then, both the high hopes that had led to the founding of the village and its gangster past had been mostly forgotten, although not by everyone. Former village leader Joseph Nozick complained, quote, "All of the beautiful ideas that my associates in the Legion and I had were swept away. The streets we built with so much arduous effort, but with happiness and hope, became little more than thoroughfares for the automobiles of gunmen, booze runners, and disorderly women. Forest View became a town that, like Cicero, you knew you'd arrived by the smell of gunpowder. Friday, May 8th was a cloudy, cooler than usual day in Chicago. Just 5 weeks after Frank's funeral at the corner of 22nd and Wabash, near the old Four Deuces, Capone's friend Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik encountered a small-time hoodlum named Joe Howard. At 28 years old, Howard, a would-be bank robber and hijacker, still lived with his mother in a flat above the small grocery store she owned. With a minor criminal record and not a lot of brains, Howard had a tough time getting a job, so he continued to mooch off his mother, much to the older woman's dismay. Jake Guzik was just rounding the street corner when Howard, who was sitting on the stoop of a nearby apartment building, lurched toward Jake and asked him for a loan. Breathing alcohol fumes into Jake's face, he turned the man down and walked past him. Howard, drunkenly offended by being turned down, chased after Jake, and when he caught him, he struck him in the face and called him, quote, a dirty little kike. It was an insult that would have dire consequences. Jake was the oldest of the Guzik brothers, and a man that Al Capone often called the only friend I really trust. They had first gotten acquainted at the Four Deuces when Jake, who had a lot of experience running brothels, joined up with the Torrio organization. More than a decade older than Capone, the pudgy, unassuming man looked more like a businessman than a gangster. In fact, he even once complained, quote, I don't know why they call me a hoodlum. I never carried a gun in my life. He rarely swore and he never used violence. He was an accountant. And he used his skills for the betterment of the brothels and later the entire bootlegging business. He managed the operations accounts to move money as needed and kept all the books, quickly becoming Torrio and Capone's top man. Torrio was impressed with Jake's skills and was impressed by how he organized everything like an actual business. When Mayor Deaver's cops closed the Four Deuces, Jake set up an office two blocks away at 2146 South Michigan Avenue and hung out a shingle that read, A. Brown, M.D. It was set up to look like a real doctor's office, although the so-called patients who came in were there to do business with Jake. Behind the lobby was a showroom of sorts with shelves that held row after row of sample liquor bottles. Retailers who wanted to place large orders could sample the wares and even have them analyzed by a chemist. This allowed their reputation for having quality booze to grow. The rest of the place was set up for Jake's private office, space for his clerical staff, and files that held the records of the organization. Six different ledgers held the secrets of the gang. One listed hundreds of individuals, hotels, and restaurants that bought wholesale quantities of liquor. A second listed all the speakeasies in Chicago they supplied. A third detailed the routes by which smuggled liquor came into the country from Canada and the Caribbean. A fourth explained the corporate structure of the breweries the operation owned or controlled. A fifth contained the assets and incomes of all the brothels. And the sixth, maybe the most important of all, listed the names of the police officers and prohibition agents that were being paid off by the mob. Earlier that spring, the organization was rattled by a police raid on the office, ordered by Mayor Deaver, that allowed those ledgers to fall into the hands of the cops. The raid had been led by Detective Sergeant Edward Birmingham, and Jake offered him $5,000 to give back the ledgers and keep silent about them. But the detective reported the offer to his superiors, and Mayor Deaver was sure he finally had the evidence to shut down Capone and Torrio's operation. But his celebration turned out to be a short one. Before the state's attorney or any federal agency could get a look at the incriminating ledgers, Judge Howard Hayes returned them to Torrio, stating they'd been illegally seized since they were outside the scope of the police search warrant. I think it's fair to say that Judge Hayes wanted to make sure that no one knew his name was listed in Jake Guzik's sixth ledger. After Jake's confrontation with Joe Howard, he told Capone about the incident. It was a lucky break for Capone. He'd been looking for an excuse to track down Howard. The small-time hoodlum had previously been overheard saying how easy it was to hijack beer trucks, including Torrio's. So Capone decided to teach him a lesson. He found Howard at Heine Jacobs' saloon on South Wabash, chatting with the owner. Two regular customers, a garage mechanic named George Bilton and a carpenter named David Runzelbeck, were drinking beer at the bar. As Capone walked through the door, Howard turned to him with an outstretched hand and greeted him by name. But Capone, who ignored the handshake, fixed Howard with a cold stare. He grabbed Howard's shoulder and demanded to know why he'd struck his friend Jake. But Howard shook off Capone's hand and sneered at him. He snapped, quote, "Go back to your girls, you dago pimp." Capone's expression barely changed as he pulled out a gun and shot Howard in the face. The police were summoned to the scene. The men who were present in the bar were questioned, and their accounts of the shooting more or less agreed. Chief of Detectives Michael Hughes told reporters, quote, "I'm certain it was Capone." He issued an order for Capone's arrest, and the next day, readers of the Chicago Tribune saw the first photograph of a face that would quickly become as familiar to them as that of President Calvin Coolidge or any Hollywood film star. The newspaper, though, still didn't get his name right. The caption under the photo read, quote, "Tony Scarface Capone, also known as Al Brown." Capone was finally in trouble, or so it seemed. In the hours between the shooting and the inquest, though, two of the witnesses developed serious cases of Chicago amnesia. Heine Jacobs testified he never actually saw the shooting. He'd gone into the back room to take a telephone call when it occurred. Yeah, that was it. David Runzelbeck now claimed he wasn't able to identify the killer. He wasn't sure who that guy was. George Bilton, the garage mechanic, well, he just disappeared without a trace. Jacobs and Runzelbeck were arrested as accessories after the fact. And hoping the charge would get them to talk, the inquest was postponed for 2 weeks. But by then, Capone was nowhere to be found, and the inquest was postponed again. Finally, on June 11th, he strolled into a police station and said, hey, he'd heard the cops were looking for him and he wanted to know why. He was taken to the criminal courts building, and he was told about the charges against him by the previously mentioned William McSwiggin, an eager young state's attorney who, thanks to his record, was often referred to as the hanging prosecutor. He questioned Capone for hours and got nothing. Capone maintained he knew nothing about the murder of some guy named Joe Howard, and that he knew no one named Torrio or Guzik. Who were those guys? He was, he insisted, a reputable businessman who dealt in antiques. The third and final date for the inquest was July 22nd. Heine Jacobs and David Runzelbeck, both men terrified and visibly shaking, said they could add nothing to their earlier testimony. It turned out to be not much of an inquest, but the jury did reach a verdict. It stated that Joe Howard was killed by, quote, one or more unknown white male persons. To this day, his murder, like so many other mob killings in Chicago in the 1920s, remains officially unsolved. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When I started this podcast, I wasn't even sure what I was doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys my products? I definitely made a fool of myself. Now I know that I was right in believing in myself and launching the podcast, despite all of the fears and the hesitations. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if I get stuck? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And their app is just objectively super dope. It's easy to use, well-designed, and helps me keep tabs on the American Hauntings clothing store while I'm on the go, or if I'm just too lazy to stare at the big screen for any longer that day. And you can trust me, my 9-to-5 job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might get confused or break technology. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
Audio coming in where you want it to and out where you need
yes
to.
Okay. Everything's good.
Perfect. Yeah. All right.
So,
ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name's Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is my friend, co-host, partner in crime, and consigliere, Cody the Nose Beck.
Yes, Troy.
Hey, good to see you after 2 weeks. Although I guess we've seen each other since then, but we did not record a postmortem. Postmortem.
Yes.
Last time for the last episode, as many of you pointed out to us, and we are sorry that we did not, maybe make a better announcement about that. I guess we should have. But
it was tough. I mean, my power's in and out. Hail,
yeah,
the
things
size
were
of
chaos.
Golf balls.
Yes, yeah, we had rain, hail, tornadoes. I think I posted a little bit of something online.
Yeah,
that we had. You know, and I'm sure not everybody saw it, but that we had. You know, skirted tornadoes. We had a water spout come across the Mississippi River.
Really?
Down by my office used to be. So we decided to just stay alive and not try and record last time. And so we are alive. We did record and we are doing the postmortem this time. And we're sorry that we didn't get the word out better than we did last time around. But, you know,
yeah,
sometimes
I think
the chaos just got away from us.
And I think half of it was like I ended up using like charging blocks and things for my computer and cell phone. And I'm like, okay, I can use my hotspot on my phone and my computer. And then if something hits the fan, I won't be able to contact anybody or do anything or go to work tomorrow. So I had to make some calls.
It was bad. I mean, the storm was bad. The hood of my car looks like the surface of the moon. It just got pounded, you know, and I've had that car for like a year. So, I mean, it's still in my world. It's still new.
Sure.
But, and then I took it in, you know, hey, insurance covers that stuff. I took it in to get it repaired.
Yeah.
I went in and they looked at it and they said, we'll fix this. We're going to have to replace your hood, though, because there's no way you can get all these dents out. And so I went in. He says, well, we'll get you an appointment made now that we got you set up. And the lady looks at her calendar and then she looks at me and she goes, OK, well, here's your appointment. How does August 10th work for you? Honest to God, I didn't even say anything. I was just like in stunned silence. I don't know anything about car repair. You know, I don't know how long this stuff takes and how many other people had come in. And I just like looked at her with my mouth hanging open, I think. And she says, will that work okay? And I'm like, yeah, that'll work. So I guess I get to drive around a dented up car for the next couple of months, but hey, at least it'll get fixed eventually.
I guess, you know, hopefully that means, though, that they do really good work. And
that's I know that they do. Their reviews are great. And everybody was super nice. It wasn't like they're like, oh, and you know, sucker.
Yeah.
You know, August 10th, that's the best we can do. And I mean, they just, I think they just been hammered by other people who also were dealing with the same thing. So anyway, we're sorry, guys, that we did not have a postmortem last time. I'd like to say you didn't miss much because it's just us and here we are again, but we're always going to just keep coming back. So anyway, but thanks for sticking with us and being patient.
Yeah. And hopefully you were all safe during the storm too. If you got hit by harder
parts. If you were in this area. Yeah. Or anywhere, I guess, probably Missouri, Illinois. I mean, there's,
it covered a
wide swath of area. So,
Well, let's not talk about the past anymore. Let's talk about what's coming up
next. So actually, I want to talk about something that's current. And that is the big sale that we just started today. Mm-hmm. We posted it in our newsletter. We posted it online and I'm telling you guys about it now. If you go to our website at dinnerandspirits.com, any of those events and tours that I host, leaving from the American Oddities Museum at downtown Alton. If you go there and you book anything and you use the promo code SPRING, that's the only word you need, SPRING, you will save 20% off everything that we have to offer on that page right now. Now, it's good for the rest of the week through Sunday night, May 17th at midnight. You can use that promo code and you can save some money. With everybody raising prices right now, you know, we thought we'd do something that lowers them a little bit, because we're also doing an event on May 23rd where, you know, to kind of fighting expensive and high prices, we're letting people come to an American Axe Murders event, which those of you who listen to the podcast know how much I love axe murders. Well, they are my favorite kind of murders. Mm-hmm. We're letting people choose their own ticket price. Now we have limited spots left, but you know, this is a special event and you can pick your price.
I love it.
Yeah, just go in, put in the amount that you want to pay and how many people in the notes that you want to bring, and we'll take care of it for you and get you on the list for that. And then you'll have access to not only the event that night, the American Axe Murders event, but you'll also have free admission to the American Oddities Museum that evening, starting at 6 o'clock. So from 6 to 7, you can see the museum. At 7, you can attend the event. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to it. We're getting a lot of people taking advantage of it. So we hope you will too. So that is two really cool things that I think are cool that we're doing to kind of fight the stupidity of high prices right now. So letting people pick their own price for May 23rd. And then we're offering that sale that all you got to do is put in the promo code SPRING, saves you 20%.
I like it. We're making stuff more accessible.
So we've got stuff coming up in May. We've got June, July, and August all up on the website right now. So that's the rest of the spring and your summer all taken care of. And you can get a discount and do some cool stuff. So people have been jumping on it today. So hopefully if you guys hear this when the episode comes out, you can join us for something. We'd love to see you. I should probably mention once again, just go to dinnerandspirits.com and you can see all the upcoming events on the website.
Awesome.
So there. How's that?
That's good. There's nothing else you want to talk about as far as upcoming?
I should probably mention the conference. Is that what you're hinting at? Yeah.
Yes.
I know we talk about the conference a lot, but time is running out, especially for the after-hour stuff. I've got a couple more things that are almost filled up, probably will be filled up this week. I know that the hotel room, the block, the discount's going to end very soon. Here's the big thing. The deadline to pre-order your shirt for 2026. I mean, we do a shirt every year for the conference, and then we never duplicate that design again. And this is another cool one, I think, this year. So it is Friday, May 15th. That is your last chance to pre-order your shirt. So if you're already signed up for the conference, but you did not order a shirt, you might want to get back in there and do that. I mean, we will have some available at the conference, but I cannot guarantee we will have enough of your size. The best way to make sure that we have it is to go ahead and get that ordered. So you can go back and order your shirt. If you have not signed up for the conference yet, now's the time to do that too. And then you can get your shirt if you do it before Friday. So yeah, things are looking good. We're excited for this year. It's going to be a lot of fun. So
it's fun every year, I'd say.
Well, it is. It is. But I think the funness, if that's not a word.
The funness.
Pretend it is a word.
Professional author, Troy Taylor.
Yes, I think it amps up every year. Well, a professional author in that I can just make up words.
That's
one of the perks.
You jujitsued my insult.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, hey, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our newest supporters on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Amanda. Another Amanda, Michelle, Ellen, Jenny, Barbara, Jeremy, Lonely Twinkle Girl, Lee, Kelly, Kylie, Tara, I'm not sure, Monica, Shauna, and Charles. So thank you very much for supporting the show. And speaking of that Patreon season, Troy, you got some new stuff with
yes, new season. Yeah, we've got the 6 full seasons on there right now that you can binge that are Patreon only. And the first episode of our new season will be next week. That will be the 19th. That will be coming out. It is season 7 and it's called Holy Terror. And it is another very bloody story, murder, mayhem. And it's the story of the only Catholic priest ever sentenced to death in American history. Fried in the electric chair. Anyway, it's a chilling story. It's one most people don't know about. That seems to be something that I'm getting a lot of demand for because I've had some other requests for other lesser known stories for the future, which I've been writing down and taking note of. But this alternative show comes out every other week. And you get special discounts, you get shirts, advanced sales on stuff, and you get more than that as a Patreon supporter. But it's the only way you can get the show. And I promise you that this is going to be a good and very blood-curdling and gross season. Even the first episode is.
Oh,
It's no eating peanut butter.
Uh-huh.
Okay. If you know, you know. Yeah. But it's still... It's a pretty grim first episode, but you can become a supporter at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Nice. Well, I'm sure this was a long time ago and the Catholic Church has cleaned up their act since then. So,
but I don't think they've, hopefully there aren't been any more murderous priests, but you know, who knows, but this is the first one. Actually, this is the only one that sentenced to death. At least I can tell you.
So there's some things worse than murder. Anyways,
maybe so.
Let's talk about a listener review. I have one this week.
Okay.
This one comes to us from Boston Brady, and it's titled "Gets Me Through Work." I'll start by saying this: if Troy read the dictionary, I'd still listen. His storytelling is incredible. Every episode is engaging, well-paced, and genuinely intriguing. I originally came for the supernatural content, but quickly realized I was hooked on every episode simply because of how well Troy tells his story. I listen while working my second job stocking shelves, and these episodes make the time fly by. It's something I genuinely look forward to, and honestly, I'm a little afraid of the day I catch up. I highly recommend this podcast. You'll be hooked from your very first episode. Well, thank you very much, Boston Brady.
Then when you catch up, you'll have to sign up for the Patreon shows.
Yes. Does it ever, like, I know we try to be, well, sometimes you try to be humble, sometimes you try to be self-deprecating and stuff, but does it blow your mind when people say, like, I'd listen to Troy read the dictionary?
Yeah, I don't understand it because I honestly can't stand to listen to myself.
Exactly. So yes.
People say that all the time and I'm like, oh God, I hate listening to myself. I really do. But thank you. Thanks to everybody who says it. I appreciate it. It is fun. I have to admit that, you know, sometimes it seems like, oh my God, how am I going to get, I've got 3 podcasts I've got to do this week kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, oh, then at first I got to write them. Then I got to record them. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh God, I don't want to hear myself anymore, but it's always fun.
Yeah.
So, I cannot complain because it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So,
and this is a little bit different than us just saying we don't like listening to ourselves or whatever, but you've been doing audio video stuff for a long time. What was it with me? I know, and I know with a lot of people, the first few times I heard my voice on recording, I was like, that's weird because it sounds different, you know.
Sure,
you.
Sure.
Did you come across that when you first started doing
stuff? Man,
or?
I gotta be honest with you, when this is an embarrassing story, but please. When I was a kid, I was probably oh man, 11, 12, maybe. We had a stereo in our basement that you could record onto 8-track tapes. This was right around the time people were starting to get cassettes, but we still had 8-tracks. And I used to do my own radio station and record it, where I would get on and talk about the news and the weather and would intro the songs and talk them up, because I love talking up songs. I just thought it would be fun to be on the radio. Later I was on the radio and it really wasn't that much fun, but you know, it was fun when I was a kid. So I heard my voice really early on
and
hated it. I've hated it ever since. I still hate it. So after all this time, it's awful. But I appreciate people being kind about listening to me talk.
So that's amazing.
Cody's been bugging me about doing my own books as audiobooks. I mean, you're not the only one, but it's like, dude, how much I mean, there's only so much time in the day.
I want to get paid.
I know. We'll
set it and forget
one
it.
one of these days. So
I think I might have told you this before at some other when we've talked about this sort of thing.
We should do a Kickstarter for an audiobook that would convince me to do it. Maybe I don't know. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No, Charlie Brackus and I used to also record our own radio shows in his house. Yeah, I remember that. We did use cassette tapes though.
Yeah, I think anybody with a taste for show business probably did that.
Yeah.
Either that or their own radio station, or TV station or whatever, with the, you know, mom and dad's video camera something, you know, I'm sure something.
Yeah.
So.
Oh gosh. Bring it up. Yeah. I did have dad's mini DV video camera.
Oh yeah, sure.
And
sure.
We made our own skateboarding videos and stuff.
Oh yeah.
Oh gosh, nostalgia. It's such a weakness. Anyway, let's talk about this.
Sure.
A pretty violent and crazy episode.
It is. It is a bit. Yeah.
And I like it. So Cicero, wasn't there a first? I was going to start. Wasn't there a pizza place called Cicero's somewhere in Illinois, St. Louis area?
Maybe.
I didn't know if you would know.
I don't remember it. It might have been around the area, like maybe before I lived here or after, or when I didn't.
One of the many times you were all over the place.
I know it's hard to say. I'm not familiar with it, but I mean, I know Salerno's in Chicago, but you know, I don't know about Cicero.
I'll Google it.
Certainly possible.
But okay, well, back to the actual story then. So Eddie Vogel opens up bookmaking a gambling operation, and it seems. I mean, this is a big deal.
He was the guy that they came to when Torrio and Capone first decided to move into Cicero. They came to Eddie Vogel because he was the guy who gave the orders to the mayor and the city council and everything. And so they had things running pretty smoothly with him. It was the other guy, was the other Eddie that was the problem.
Right. <You know>? Right. Yes. And part of this is, Frankie Pope is in charge of a floating handbook. And initially I wrote down like a ledger question mark, but then you go into details about the 6 ledgers they have.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in a floating handbook was, it was like a bookie joint. Mm-hmm. And they called it a floating one because they could easily just kind of pick things up and move them. Now at this point later on, it would be the mob who takes advantage of the National Racing Wire. They're the ones, as far as horse races around the country. At this point, they're mostly betting on horse races and dog tracks in the Chicago area, and then kept up to date by telephone as far as the winnings go. So it was a bookmaking shop, but it was a floating book because they could move it so easily.
Right.
And they would always get a warning before, you know, the obligatory raids on the place, and then they just pack everything up and move them to another spot temporarily.
Right. Yeah. Got it. So even though there are physical ledgers for their stuff,
we'll get to that. Right out of the Untouchables.
The floating handbook itself is more of a concept of the operation able to move around, be nimble. It's nice, you know, because it's like you set up a a meth lab or something harder to move real quick.
Yeah,
you
it
know?
Is. It is. But it's a really kind of the same idea, though, unless you have in an RV. it is hard to move, but, you know, still fairly simple.
Yes.
In that this is what they were doing with this. So.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. The RV thing is a great example. yes, I love that. So something I thought was interesting is during Frank's funeral, the saloon shut down for 2 hours, just like an out of respect sort of thing. I guess I get it. I guess it's like taking off your hat. It's like, you know,
I mean, you know, it was, you know, because that's, I mean, that's the way they made their living, and that's the, you know, that, and so everybody closing down because they got their booze from, you know, Capone and Torrio, it was a sign of respect.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And then, you know, that was the end of Frank. So much mm-hmm. for that. And then we move on, you know, and, you know, Al still in mourning for a while, but it didn't slow him down as far as the work that needed to be done. And they eventually, as I mentioned, had 161. Listen,
that's ridiculous.
Cicero only had 16,000 people in it at the time. I mean, it was growing. It was growing, and they would have, like, I think tripled that amount by the end of the 1920s. But still, it's not a very big town.
So that's a saloon for every 100 people, kind of thing.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, 123 saloons and all the different
gambling spots. Okay, yeah.
123 saloons and 161 gambling operations.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, but not a single brothel within city limits.
Yes,
at
yes,
least.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. No. That number, I meant to write it down, but because it just stuck in my head, because I was thinking, like, holy shit, I thought Grafton had a lot of saloons back in the day and stuff, and this is
right.
Add the gambling stuff and the saloons.
Yeah,
and
quadruple it.
Yes.
Right.
that is amazing. And as you mentioned earlier, Eddie Vogel's not the one that we really not the problem maker.
Right.
This one, how do you pronounce this guy?
Eddie
name?
Tansel.
Tansel.
Eddie Tansel is the guy who's the problem.
Gotcha.
So he's the former prize fighter. I mentioned him mm-hmm. in an episode or two ago, who had killed somebody in the ring.
Right.
You know, had beaten somebody to death in the ring. And then, you know, he got out and he went into his own, you know, started up his own operations, but wouldn't have anything to do with whatever Eddie Vogel said. Didn't want Torrio and Capone moving into his town. And he just kept being a pain in the ass. And, you know, he's defying Torrio. And of course, you might remember the West Side O'Donnells, not Spike and his brothers, the uh-huh. other O'Donnells that were on the west side of Chicago heading out towards Cicero. They were the ones who were really kind of distributing the beer and stuff, but they were working within Torrio's syndicate. So they were allies.
Got it.
And so everybody's had a problem with Eddie Tansel. And then they're pushing him, you know, he's pushing them. He's taunting them to do something about it. And then they decide to push him into some sort of action, which is when Miles and his friend John Doherty go in after their, you know, after a long night of drinking and start trouble. And it leads to leads to violence.
Yes, yes. Tansel and O'Donnell both shoot each other in the chest.
Yeah. And then just keep on fighting.
We're just getting started here.
Yeah. Yeah.
O'Donnell ends up killing the bartender. Somehow they both, well, for at least a little bit, survive a lot of the shots they've taken and are able to get outside. And then O'Donnell.
Well, Miles does. It's Eddie Tansel who doesn't survive in the end.
I'm sorry. But he says, "Get him. He got me."
I know. That's a dying good line.
It's a great line.
It's a good line.
That's a great line. So then Martin Simmet kicks O'Donnell to death. I'm guessing.
Well, he tries. He tries to kick him to death. He kicks him. He kicks him and leaves him for
until
dead.
He stops moving. Okay.
Right. Gotcha. So he stops moving, and then he. Jim Doherty managed to get away, although he's wounded. He's covered mm-hmm. in blood, gets to the hospital, and Miles was shot 4 times.
Yeah, dude.
And still was beaten to within an inch of his life and ended up spending about 3 weeks in the hospital to recover.
Whew.
Only to get indicted to get charges filed against him when he got out, but then the grand jury wouldn't indict him.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for, again, obvious reason.
Of course, yeah, of course. You know, yeah, what's the Chicago amnesia and all that stuff too?
Yeah,
and
yeah, that'll come up a couple of times in this episode. Yeah,
that is some tough son of a bitch. Man, I had a really bad hangnail earlier. I almost called off work. And these guys are getting shot four times.
Yeah, like, yeah. And can you imagine?
And I like dudes are dying and still trying to crawl to each other to,
to keep fighting. Yeah. Yeah, to keep trying to kill each other. Yeah.
Oh, and I guess that's why they said, what if you smell gunpowder, you're in Cicero.
You're in Cicero. Yeah, that's a good line too.
Many great lines.
Definitely a Chicago reporter, an unnamed reporter, unfortunately. But, you know, those guys were pretty sharp for the most part. I mean, you know, they were feeding people their version of the news. I mean,
sure.
Because not everything was always accurate, you know, but and I always love and we'll get more of them. But the nicknames are always the best. You know?
Oh, God. What was the Greasy Thumb one? Or
yeah. Jake Greasy Thumb Guzik. And I don't know where that one came from. I would love to know where that came from. And I get it. It's comes from licking your finger to turn pages, see, because he was an accountant. And I know that's where it came from, but it sounds really bad.
It sounds very gross. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like a proctology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I don't like it. Yeah.
I don't like it.
I don't
it
like the nickname. I would not like that one. But I wasn't, like I said, it wasn't like he gave it to himself. And probably neither did his buddy. Some fucking reporter probably gave it to him. So
I love it. It's to be like, this is Tommy Sticky Toes, you know?
Yeah,
like,
right.
What do I want to know? Like, no, probably not. Well, let's talk about a more depressing part of this is Forest View.
Yeah,
it's so sad. I feel like what happened to this group of people. Like,
I mean, these guys came to it with the best of intentions, as right? We know how that always ends up. But this, you know, attorney Joseph Nozick comes in, and it's this nice little place. It's just a collection of houses. They don't even have a post office. You know, 300 people live there, and it's just so nice. And he convinces some buddies. I mean, he's a war veteran. He's a member of the American Legion, and he convinces a bunch of them to invest and turn it into a town. And they do, and it's really nice, and he's like the guy in charge of the police, and his brother's the president of the village board, and then they end up with some guy named Porky Dillon, who is the police chief.
Yes.
And you should know, never hire anyone with the nickname Porky, just in case. I don't know, it just seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, then of course, you know, Porky is a plant from, you know, to works for Torrio, and then come in and turn the place into
chaos.
I mean, 300 people, they build a hotel in a so-called social club, which is just a huge brothel.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest one they have. It's their biggest brothel, and it becomes like an area where, you know, they're going to store booze and guns, and they're going to move girls around from this place to other places. And they kind of use it as a clearinghouse for business. And, you know, it is just like, this guy's really unhappy with what's going on. And he's like, we got to get rid of these guys. And apparently he mentioned it to old Porky Dillon, who then told Ralph Capone about it. And Ralph comes to see him and says, hey, listen, I hear one more thing you say about me and my brother, I'm going to throw you in the canal. And he thinks he's joking. He thinks he's just kidding around, because they'd had a really nice conversation up until that point.
Right.
And then he just says, oh, well, you know, hey, if I go in the canal, you'll go in with me. Ha ha. Yeah, he wasn't kidding. Not at all. And so things don't end up well for Nozick or any of the other guys who'd started this town. And it really just kind of becomes a shithole.
Yeah.
And people start calling it Caponeville and everything. But, and I did kind of jump ahead a few years to when a couple of guys show up and they burn down the Maple Inn.
Yes, yes.
And nobody does anything to stop it. The fire department's like, we don't have any water.
Yeah.
What do you mean you don't have any water? Yeah, well, you know, they just let it burn down.
You know how these things go.
The cops are like, good riddance. Yeah. We're not even going to bother to find out who did it, because they knew who did it. You know, I mean, it was pretty obvious. So,
yeah, it seems, I mean, yeah, these guys, Nozick and them, get the brakes beaten off them and forced to move. And Torrio and Capone have a free run of the town. Like I said, yeah, you said they set it on fire, but I do like the tunnels and underground behind the wall. The eye cutouts.
Yeah,
and the
all
paintings.
The stories, all the things you hear about Capone hideouts and things. This is like the epitome. This is like where all those stories got started because of this place, you know, with the tunnels and the escape routes and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was really there, but I mean, it's long gone now. There's nothing there at all now.
I think the part that I think was the saddest about it to me is that once they, you know, they took advantage of this and, you know, it burns down or whatever. And then there's like, let's fuck it. Let's move on. Like, they just use up whatever they can, whoever they can, anything they can, and move on to the next.
Exactly.
You know,
oh yeah.
On to the next.
Again, I'm gonna refer you back to the episode of The Sopranos with Robert Patrick, who owns the sporting goods store, who borrows some money from Tony and then can't pay it back. These guys are your friends until they're not.
Yeah.
You know, you should never make friends with organized crime unless you know that you've got a way out of it. Mm-hmm. And even then, I'm not sure I'd recommend it. So.
Yeah, if you see a guy, if a guy's in a pinstripe suit and a fedora and he's flipping a coin with a toothpick in his mouth, don't take any money from him. You're hard up for cash.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
All right, last thing I want to talk about is Jake Guzik, the accountant. And not a hoodlum, as he self-proclaims.
As he always says, yes. Which, I mean, you know, he was an accountant. I mean, he just happened to be a good friend of Capone's. And as I mentioned, Capone always called him the only friend I really trust.
Yeah.
You know, and he would be with him until the very end. Mm-hmm. I will give him that. I mean, Jake Guzik was loyal to a fault, you know, and for obvious reasons, once you see the way that Capone decides to take care of somebody who gives him a hard time.
Yes, so, Joe Howard, yes.
Yeah, hits him and calls him a dirty little kike, you know. Capone did not take that line down.
So. Well, and Capone gets called a slur himself, I believe.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
And shoots him in the face.
Yeah.
That's pretty much where I was going to end it. But before that, I just wanted to say he's got his doctor's office and tons of ledgers and things there. But I love the sample liquor bottles.
It's a great idea. It is. And they were trying to show, you know, what high quality their stuff was. You could come in and you could, you know, taste the goods. You could have a chemist come in and take a sample of it. I mean, I think the point was they were trying to show that their stuff was not nasty like, you know, the Guinness. You know, it's not some kind of home brew somewhere that they're cooking up. They wanted it to be something that was good and something that people could count on, you know, and know that it was tasty.
So high quality, consistent product.
All
right. Basically, it'll get you drunk. That's what they're trying to make sure.
Well, but it will, but also won't
blind you.
Make you go blind from it or kill you. So you might be drunk, but you're going to be blind and dead. But that's not, you know, this is better quality stuff than that.
And I know he says he's not a hoodlum, but listen, just because you're not the one carrying a gun doesn't mean you're not.
Yeah,
still.
Right. It doesn't. Yeah, exactly. But I do. The thing with the six ledgers is interesting.
Absolutely.
Especially if you've seen like the Untouchables and they're looking for one ledger, you know, and it's like, one ledger would not have contained everything they needed. But to put it into context, the ledger they were looking for in the Untouchables, when they were looking for the bookkeeper, who they never gave him a name, and believe me, that guy looked nothing like Jake Guzik. If that's who he was supposed to be, but it had the names of all the cops, the judges, the prohibition agents, and everybody, and that was ledger number six, and that was the big one. And I find it interesting when the judge gives them back their ledgers and says, "Oh yeah, it was illegally seized." It wasn't. But the judge is going to say it is, and I'm going to make sure, you know, that nobody knows my name's in there, because I would be willing to bet that it was.
Yeah, you rip out that damn page. I have a notebook that's like fake leather and has like strapped. It looks like an Indiana Jones thing or whatever. Oh, sure, that's sure. What I like to imagine their ledgers all look like.
Yeah,
like
I picture them like those old fashioned, well, kind of like in the movie, but those old fashioned ones that are, have the real ornate cover with the different, like black with like a, like speckles in it. And then the corners are like leather. They're like a burgundy colored leather at the corners. And that's what I picture.
I can see that.
Big stacks of ledgers being.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like, I know that they keep a lot of that because, you know, you got to have records for that business to usually run, but then insurance policies and stuff. But then it's also like if somebody does get a hold of these things,
right,
so many people.
Well, yeah, that's you always hear about, you know, these companies, and I'm sure it's not that way anymore because everything's computerized. But back in the day, you'd hear about companies that always kept a second set of books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, the real story was in the other ledger. Mm-hmm. You know, and everybody did everything by hand back then, and so people were looking for the other, you know, the other set of books.
Why do you have two sets of books?
Just, I don't know, it's a cool kind of nostalgic kind of thing, you know. I don't know, that's the best way I can describe it.
So, I know I need to start writing down my crimes more and
yeah, that seems like a bad idea apparently, because we've heard how many times have people gotten caught because of stuff like that?
Right.
I mean, Capone went to prison because of a second set of books, you know, or actually just a set of books, because this is not the kind of stuff you should probably be writing down.
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, is there anything else? Can I move on then?
No, I don't think so. I think we're good. I do think it's funny that once again, even though it was Capone's first time, his picture is in the paper, mm-hmm. you know, and nobody had ever seen his picture in the paper before, but soon they, of course, were going to, but they still got his name.
Yes, yes.
Tony Scarface Capone.
It's amazing.
Tony, you know, I don't know where that came from, but, you know.
They're probably just figured. He's probably Tony.
But yeah, no, he walked in, you know, shot that guy in the face and walked out. And, you know, at first everybody's like, oh yeah, it was that Al Capone guy. And then suddenly no one can remember, you know. And then one of the witnesses just disappears altogether.
Yeah.
And he probably took off. I don't even think anybody had to kill him. I think he just
probably
left, which was smart. You know, probably turned out to be smart.
Yes. So. Oh my gosh. Well, it is now time for our Ghost Rider segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. This email comes to us from John with the subject line Ronald Hunkler Writings. And John writes, "Hi, I enjoyed several of your books and just finished rereading The Devil Went to St. Louis. On rereading, there was a passage about
Ronnie. He came to St. Louis, though.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sorry.
The devil came to St. Louis. Okay. Well, I'm just saying. The devil went down to Georgia, but he didn't went to St. Louis. He came to St. Louis.
The man bought your book. Just
no, no, I know. I was correcting you.
I was I was reading what he said.
Never mind. Okay. Sorry, man. Sorry.
Sorry. John. Sorry, John. On rereading, there's a passage about Ronnie writing on the sheets and then on paper brought to him by his cousin. Do any of these writings still exist? Thanks, John. I know you talk about papers in
well, it was a big sheet of newsprint from his uncle's print shop.
Mm-hmm.
And he put it up on the wall and they kind of just stuck Ronnie in front of it and he started writing. If they do, they're filed away somewhere with the rest of the files. I don't know anyone who has seen them since 1949. I don't know of them. There's no mention of them in anywhere else. So my guess would be they were turned over to Father Bowdern and Father Bishop, that the sheet was. And so if Father Bishop kept it, they probably put it in the files.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way for us to know that because we're never going to get to see them. So files will never be opened. So
got it. Well, hey, thanks for writing.
But it's interesting. It's an interesting question, though.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
Because I know we talked about a bedside table that somebody or desk or something, somebody found papers or diary.
Right.
Or something.
That was the copy. That was a typed up copy of the notes that Father Bishop kept from the exorcism.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you never know what you're going to find, I guess, with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Would you get some hotline stuff then?
I do. You guys, if you, you have those comments or questions, you can send them to Cody via email, or you can text us on the hotline. And that number is 217-791-7859. And, I've got a few, and the first few that I want to cover here, are something that, I think that we need to address. just a little bit. So let me get through those, and then Cody and I will kind of address this, and this might help some of you guys, because a lot of you have written in about this, and we're somewhat baffled, but we're working on it.
Right, we're listening.
Anyway, this one comes to us from Crystal in the 618, and she said, "Hey, I was listening to Riddled with Bullets. That was the past episode, and I've also been having the audio issue where I have the volume all the way up on my phone but can barely hear anything through my headphones. After some digging, I realized that Spotify had messed with some volume controls during an update, and that's what was making it quieter. So that might be the same for others and not an issue on your end. To fix it, I found that if I go into settings on the Spotify app and go to playback, then scroll all the way down to the volume controls and pick between quiet, normal, and loud." I didn't know about this. Anyway, longtime listener and fan, found your show during the section of the St. Louis season about the Limp family, and eventually went back and listened to everything and have been caught up mostly caught up ever since. I love the parts at the end with Cody usually asks what I would have emailed or texted about. Also loving American Dread and American Nightmares, and plan on subbing to the Patreon in a bit. Hope to get to one of your dinners or events and meet you guys in person. So,
awesome.
She also says, P.S. Since I usually listen at work, I consider you and Cody honorary baristas.
Hey, well, thank you. Yeah.
All right. So this one, again, kind of following along the same line. This one comes to our friend Joe from Short and Stout Designs. They're good friends of ours. They have a lot. If you've been to some of our, like, Dead of Winter or the conference or something, you've seen their stuff. You've probably bought some of their stuff. But I just heard the most recent episode, Joe says, about the quiet audio. I thought it might have been just me, but yes, the volume is very low. I listen while I drive for my day job, and of all my podcasts I listen to, yours is the lowest volume. I have the audio on my phone and van both maxed. I'm still hoping I can get it louder. And sometimes, like this most recent, the first part is okay, then the second part is very low. Been meaning to mention it whenever I see you, but always forget. It does keep me on my toes, though, because the following episode of whatever comes up blasts me.
Sorry.
Hope this helps. You guys are great. Thanks for doing what you do. So I don't know if Joe listens on Spotify. I don't know if that will help or not. This one comes to us from Christine, the 865. She says, "I'm having the same issue with the volume in my car's Bluetooth, but not on my earbuds. So not sure what's wrong. My volume turned up on my phone and car." Again, it might be something about Spotify, or another thing that I found out, especially when it comes to your car and sometimes with your headphones too. A few years ago, Apple put in these settings that would max out your volume and shut it down if it was too loud. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And you could get into your settings and then you make your car or your headphones. I just did it with everything. Make it an other. It'll say, "Is this a headphones or is this?" Because we don't want to hurt your hearing. So, well, it's not your problem. My hearing is my problem, and I'm deaf as a post.
Yeah.
That's on me.
Yeah.
But I just made everything other so that it wouldn't keep turning it down.
Yeah.
It's driving me crazy.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I was gonna say, I do still want to say, like, because, you know, Troy and I are the first people to be like, we've had some audio issues that have been completely our fault.
Absolutely.
So we're trying to figure it out. And like I was talking to him earlier today. I'm gonna take some more time with this episode tonight. I haven't been doing anything differently.
But I'm
gonna look into it, because we're hearing you, and when multiple people
are listening.
I do want to see if there's something I can do on my end. Then I'm gonna figure it out. So yeah, we're listening to
you.
We've had some
other people who wrote in to tell us the same thing that we've had people write in to tell us about the missing postmortem from the last episode.
Yeah.
Which wasn't missing. It was just never recorded. And then we've had other people who have written in, and we do know there are some volume issues apparently going on. And one of our listeners in the 513 says it's just our show they're having the problem with, and that their phone volume is turned up, and sometimes commercials will come blaring through because the sound is so loud. They've got it turned up.
Damn.
But thought it was just them, but it is not, it's other people too. And like I said, we're not for sure, you know, exactly, but we're working on it. This one comes to us from Diana, who is
podcast listener of the year.
Was talking about how hopefully everything was okay with the tornado and stuff. And then she also adds, oh, I realized they never reached out to Cody about the stories in Stones. So you guys must have talked about this.
Yeah.
Cody, message me. If you haven't fleshed this one out yet, I'm wondering about building a network of regional historians to tackle cemetery stories, depending on the stones in question. So you might get a hold of her. And you guys can hash that out. It's just we have not had a postmortem, so I couldn't tell you about
I appreciate it.
That's another one about the sound that we're working on. Let's see, this one is, my name's Tina, I'm the trucker from 1995. It comes from the 618. It says, thank you for telling listeners about rest areas not being safe, and because they really need to know. So we were talking about rest areas, I think, recently. She says, I'm from Collinsville, Illinois, and I can't remember if you did any digging into the mobsters back in the day from our area. Buster Wertman was the number one from what I heard. And yes, that is all connected to the Capone stuff. And that's really a little more gangsters of Southern Illinois stuff. That was kind of a different book I did. But she also says that I heard Capone had a place in Pocahontas, Illinois, to run away to. So I'm betting that's where the vault is, because we've talked about the vault recently on my Facebook page. I was talking about the anniversary of the Geraldo Rivera store. We'll get to that later on in this season. So that's what we've got coming up right now, as far as things on the haunt line. So we're pretty much caught up. So thank you guys for weighing in about the sound. Like I said, we're going to work on it, but check into that Spotify thing if that's how you listen. I don't know that it'll help, but it's worth a shot. And we're going to see what's going on our end too.
Yeah.
And we appreciate all of the constructive and polite feedback we've gotten. Mm-hmm. We don't appreciate the non-polite feedback that we've gotten.
And we won't.
We're doing the best that we can, for a free podcast. But anyway, we are doing the best we can, and we want it to be a good experience for everybody. So, We're on it. We're trying.
We're working on it. We're doing what we can. And
if you've got a constructive idea, you can feel free to pass it on to Cody or I, or you can text it or just send it directly to Cody, because he usually is the one that messes with that stuff. But if it's coming up for you on our other podcast too, like Dread or Nightmares, let us know.
Yeah.
Because then that's, you know, either some Cody or points. I are messing with those. So we need to know. So, but thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
So, all right. Well, you ready to wrap this thing up?
Let's do it.
All right. Thanks again for checking out the story in the postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. We hope you'll give all of our shows a try, the current ones and the ones that are coming soon. And if you love them as much as we love making them, you'll tell other people about it and encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you listen, which makes it easier for others to find us. To say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast, and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from the online store, which you'll find at AmericanHauntings.net. Or don't forget, this week, coming up this week through Sunday, use the promo code SPRING for anything from dinner and spirits, and that'll get you 20% off. But you can also use that 10% off podcast promo code at Cody's shirt store too. You can use that same discount, and that store is at AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. Just remember, this podcast is not the only thing we offer. American Hauntings is also books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. While that makes the company sound big, we are not. We are a small business that is more grateful for your support than you could possibly know.
All right. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and it is very meticulously produced and edited by Cody Beck. That's me tonight. To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. You can find out more about the podcast network there, or you can reach out to us with comments, questions, suggestions, and complaints via email or by text on the haunt line. You can also sometimes find us on social media where we post stories and updates on Facebook and Instagram. I just took a picture of my cat laying right next to us while we're recording. So you'll see stuff like that.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
All right.
Let's see. Okay, cool.